Welcome back to Pretentious, a podcast about the albums and artists that have shaped the past decade of indie music culture as chosen by Pitchfork Media. I'm Trevor Ickrath.
I'm Dylan Flynn. Trevor, how are we already back doing this? This whole, like, irregular recording schedule on this show makes this show feel like the weirdest of all the shows we've done.
Yeah, it's thrown me for a loop because we had, what, like a month and a half break between episode one and two, but this was only, what, like
it
2 weeks?
It felt like there was a year between episode one and two and a day between episode two and three to me.
Yeah, and I mean, in that time, what's happened? The president of the United States, the leader of the free world himself, has contracted the novel coronavirus for one,
and Sufjan Stevens released an album for two.
That's true, but I think it's appropriate that we're recording this so soon after Trump caught COVID, because today we're going to be talking about something that I've always kind of considered a disease in its own way, something I like to call bleepy bloopy syndrome.
Oh yeah, bleepy bloopy syndrome. Gotta watch out for it.
Yeah, it's frequently contracted by singer-songwriters, and notable symptoms include stuff like throwing away your guitars and buying synthesizers.
I heard you did the opposite.
Maybe according to James Murphy, but you can't believe a thing that guy says.
In any case, I do think that this particular disease peaked in the years of between 2000 and 2010. So for now, just be on the lookout, be vigilant, practice, you know, common sense, but probably won't happen to you.
What would the bleepy bloopy equivalent of some coronavirus precautions be? Maybe instead of washing your hands every hour, you like tune your guitar every hour.
Yeah.
You send your drummer like an email just to check in every now and then, like, hey buddy, I really value you. I'm not going to replace you with any drum machines soon.
And like, you know, if you're saying like, I don't like that rhythm track, we should get rid of that. You know, experiment with tones first before you scrap it.
Hey, let's jump back in time though and talk about what was going on the day that the record we're going to be talking about was released. October 12th, 2010.
Trevor, that day, that very day, the first of 33 Chilean miners who were trapped for over 2 months was rescued.
How appropriate that such a miracle would occur on the same day an album would be released by a guy who frequently sings about miracles.
Yeah, it's like a man came out of a cave after a long time, and then Sufjan Stevens came out of a cave after a long time. It's very... there's a parallel there, right?
Biblical events.
Is there a parallel with the number one movie that week, The Social Network?
Oh, well, Facebook. You know, I mean, as a society, we were starting to live more and more online. And isn't that kind of like a folk artist putting down his banjo and going electronic in a way?
Yeah, and if you're on Facebook, those targeted ads make you feel like you're in the age of ads.
Good point. And that's not how you pronounce the album name, but good point.
Well, yeah, I know. Happy birthday to Wolverine actor Hugh Jackman, who turned 42 that day.
Wolverine, not a character not unlike that of one Jesus Christ, I would say. There are a lot of parallels there.
Yeah, there are a lot of parallels.
He was once crucified in those comics on a big axe. I remember that happening.
I do believe Jesus was very short, so it's all coming together.
You know it's not short, though?
Boy, do I ever.
Literally any album that this dude has released. Today we're going to be talking about The Age of Odds by Sufjan Stevens.
It's been a long, long time since I've memorized your face. It's been 4 hours now since I've wandered through your place. And when I sleep on your couch, I feel very safe. And when you bring the blankets, I cover up my face. I do.
The Age of Odds, Trevor, and I said on the last episode, I've not listened to this album since it came out, and so I've spent the last 2 weeks with it, and we got an album to talk about, that's for darn sure.
First off, tell me what you think about Sufjan Stevens in general, as well as like your history with him, and what you were doing around the time this album came out.
He's not one of my guys, Trevor.
No?
I like him. I do like him. I think he's super talented, and I think he's got a great ear, and he's a good instrumentalist. I think that his downfall for me is that he kind of, like, can't help but super overthink everything. And there are times when that process has yielded some really brilliant stuff. But there are also times when it's yielded material that, to me anyway, feels super overthought.
Yeah, you know, I frequently see him referred to in reviews and such as like an overachiever. And there is that kind of vibe to him. He's like that kid you went to school with who goes up in front of the class and does a 40-minute presentation that makes your homework look like shit.
It just makes me always feel an arm's length from the music. Not always, because I do. There's some Sufjan Stevens music that I think is like so transcendent and undeniable in its genius. But a lot of the other stuff, it makes it feel like I'm in a museum sort of and saying like, oh, I see what's going on here. Okay, that's very interesting. Yeah.
He does have big museum tour guide energy.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. What about you, Trevor? Where do you land with Sufjan?
I don't know if I'd go as far to call him one of my guys. He'd be like maybe like a B-tier or C-tier guy. He's not somebody who I would call like one of my very favorite artists, but he is like a musician that I have kept up with over the course of the past like 15 years or so. I think I got into him around like 2006 or 2007 when I picked up Illinois on CD. And it was like a big staple of like, When I first got my car and learned to drive, I would listen to Illinois on my way to school every morning. Not the entire thing, because I didn't have like a hour and a half commute.
Crazy commute.
Like, yeah, the beginning at least. So I'm very familiar with the first like half hour of that record and the rest of it. But the first half hour was like a morning listen for me.
You really forged an emotional bond with it. The other thing Definitely. About Sufjan is worth, I think, mentioning, Trevor, is that like our first episode we did Arcade Fire, and that kind of feels like maybe the number one of all the artists you think about when you think about this Pitchfork era. Sufjan's right up there, man. This is one of the big heavy hitters of this kind of, you know, blog sign off, prestige music.
Oh, yeah, and I think another parallel to be drawn there is that that kind of status of his can really be attributed to, like, one big landmark album, even though he does have, like, a pretty consistent body of work. Like I said, Illinois was kind of like his calling card for a long time.
Definitely an Arcade Fire parallel there. I agree.
Another thing I think is worth talking about Sufjan is that this dude is kind of like indie rock's answer to Christian rock. He, throughout a lot of his music, he explores, like, Christian themes. Does that have anything, like, how have you approached that part of his body of work? Because when I got into him, I was going to Catholic high school, and I wasn't like very religious at the time, but I had spent like years and years learning about all these Bible stories, so I really had like an in to be interested in like the kind of stuff that he was frequently singing about.
I mean, I believe in God, and I'm a socialist, so there's a lot that I really enjoy about Jesus. I'm comfortable with Christianity and my music artist, Trevor. I've never shirked it or shied away from artists who go there. I mean, there's the big obvious ones like your U2s and Sufjan, and probably you would also throw like In the Earth, Mine, Over the Sea is a big example of kind of weaving those themes into music.
Jeff Mangum did famously love Jesus Christ.
It's true. He came right out and said it. I would even go like a little deeper. There's some like Christian indie artists who I think are really interesting. Half-Handed Cloud, who was like kind of a protege of Sufjan's for a while, I think is a really interesting musician. I'm not afraid to expose myself to music that is coming from a place of faith or exploring biblical themes. I think it's just as interesting as any other kind of like, you know, literarily focused Fiona Apple song or whatever.
Will you be afraid when the revelation comes and you are forced to expose yourself to God and be judged for all of your sins?
I mean, I'll either be afraid or I'll just be like, well, I guess this was coming. One or the other, right?
We got some stuff to hash out. This will take a minute. Pull up a stool, dude.
I think the best tone to take with St. Peter in that moment is just to, like, as they recount the worst things you ever did in your life, just go like, oh, yeah, yeah, I remember that too. Yeah.
Do you remember your initial reactions to Age of Odds when it came out?
I remember Age of Odds coming out and me thinking, this is an album that takes a while to get through, and I don't like a lot of my time with it.
Okay.
I remember really, really loving the last song of it.
Oh, yeah, Impossible Soul.
And eventually just kind of playlisting it and not really coming back to the rest of it ever.
I remember this felt like a really big moment in the Sufjan Stevens kind of like narrative. Like, we'll talk about this more throughout the episode, I'm sure, but before this, he was really known for being like a very, very twee, extravagantly produced folk singer-songwriter with lots of banjos and acoustic guitars and string arrangements. But here he went like full towards the electronics.
Illinois and Before, there's almost like a I dare you to call me corny, like earnestness to it.
Mm-hmm.
And then here it is the place where it feels like the irony starts to seep in and like there's a little bit more straight-facedness going on.
And this is also, I think, where he developed a little bit more of an edge. Today, I think of, like, Sufjan Stevens as a guy who's, like, kind of a little crazy and, like, could be prone to do anything at any moment. Like, a big thing I associate with him is this post he made on his Tumblr in 2013. Do you remember this? When he just posted, like, a picture of himself dressed like, just like a total frat bro with the caption, Papa Molly, get jolly, spring break 2013, New York is a dream to me now.
Wow, I don't remember that at all.
He mentions in an interview about this record that it has like a kind of like hysterical melodrama to it. And I think that was definitely something new for him at the time. A lot of his stuff didn't seem as personal and definitely didn't seem as like crisis driven. But here he feels like he's like really losing it.
I think we'll probably talk about that with a little bit more focus as we go on. But I agree with you that there it kind of feels like a shedding of innocence, if you will.
That's a good way to put it. So let's get into it. You know, what we like to do on the show is talk about these records in context of the artist's broader career, or at least, you know, their entire relationship with Pitchfork. So let's get into it and talk about Sufjan Stevens' early career and his backstory and everything that led up to this record.
This is something I didn't know. Sufjan is a Persian word and it means to come with a sword, Trevor.
Extremely badass.
Yeah, or I guess also you could call that sounding. He was born in Detroit, Michigan.
That was really bad. No one's even going to get that except for like me and other perverts in the audience.
I was just gonna move forward. That was just gonna be for who it was for, and then sure, everybody else would be like, oh, Detroit, Michigan in 1975. That makes sense.
Let's hope sounding always stays for who it's for.
Well, he was born in Detroit, Michigan in 1975. He was in some garage bands, Trevor. I don't know if you're aware.
He was in this band called Con Los Dudes.
With the Dudes.
With the Dudes.
It's a really good garage band name.
It definitely is.
He was in a folk rock band, too, called Marzuki.
That's a pretty good one, too. Yeah. Not as good as With the Dudes, but it wasn't until his first semester of college that he recorded his first solo album, A Sun Came, which he released on Asthmatic Kitty Records in 2000.
Dylan listened to it for the first time 2 days ago.
Yeah, I feel like I listened to this thing like once forever ago, back when I was like first learning about who Sufjan Stevens was, and I haven't listened to it since.
I listened to it 2 days ago, and I liked it a little bit more than the next one, but I didn't like it very much.
The next one is Enjoy Your Rabbit, which he recorded after he moved to New York City in 2001 and enrolled in a writing program at the New School for Social Research.
But isn't it interesting how this move from A Sun Came to Enjoy Your Rabbit is like a fractal version of the moment from Illinois to Age of Odd.
This is where he really started to kind of mess around with like electronic stuff. Not too many people know about this, but this was really his first foray into like electronic music.
I think it was received like, you know, moderately well in the critical world. It didn't light it. It just did not break Sufjan Stevens through. Pitchfork did review it.
Yeah, it was his first record reviewed by Pitchfork. They gave it a 7.7 It was reviewed by Jason Nicky, who described like initially being skeptical about Sufjan's pivot towards electronics, which seems like an odd thing to do on the guy's first Pitchfork record, right? To reference his previous career as if it's like setting a tone for this new one.
Yeah, it's kind
of
weird.
Not a lot of
right?
continuity yeah. there, but he ultimately deemed it to be like a worthy and fully realized experiment.
I don't like this record.
Another one that I haven't listened to in years. I did like check out the song that they say is the best one in that review, Year of the Dragon, which is like this 9-minute electronic experimental piece. I was gonna like play a clip from it here, but it just didn't really work as a needle drop.
Yeah, Year of the Dragon and Year of the Rat are like the two like super long serious statement ones, I guess, but I just don't think there's a keeper on this record. I don't like this record.
Yeah, things don't really start cooking until his next release, which was in 2003. Now we got to talk about Michigan.
Hey, now we're talking.
Yes.
Now we're talking.
Specifically about the state of Michigan.
Michigan, I think, is a pretty great record, and it's the first of his two state records that's devoted entirely to his home state of Michigan, and as in the promotional cycle of this record is when Sufjan, like, made this big announcement that would... That to this day, Trevor, in a very weird way, still kind of defines the way that people think and talk about Sufjan Stevens.
It does, yeah. You're talking, of course, about his now infamous 50 States project, which would allegedly find him hypothetically recording an album for each of the 50 United States of America.
Right, and it's, you know, spoiler alerts, long abandoned. But it still feels like, you know, if somebody brings up Sufjan Stevens, there's going to be a crack about the state albums coming in the next lull in the conversation, you know?
He'll probably never live it down. Hey, let's listen to a song from Michigan, though. How about For the Widows in Paradise?
That's a great one. Put it on.
I feel like that's pretty indicative of what Sufjan would generally sound like over the course of his next several records. Folk arrangements, really whispery vocals, soft, gentle delivery.
It's very bright. It's very clean. It's got a kind of a, I would say, like a wintry sound to it, which makes sense for Michigan, which does spend much of its year frozen. Yeah, I think Michigan is a really solid record. It's probably in that like second tier of Sufjan Stevens records for me, of like really great records that's got, because I mean, it's got a lot of songs on it that I like, Trevor. I like, what's that last one called?
Vito's Ordination Song. Yeah, If Impossible Soul isn't my favorite Sufjan Stevens closer, Vito's Ordination Song definitely is.
And I mean, Romulus is really good, and Detroit and Flint are both really good. That record's just, I think it's very strong. It's like, it does not feel like it's shaking under its concept at all to me. It feels very natural.
Yeah, it's like super fully realized in terms of the 50 States thing too. I mean, like, if you ask me to guess, I would say this would maybe be like the third or fourth entry in the project, not the debut of it.
Right, yeah, it's definitely all in on the conceptual hook. It did break the boy through, and maybe not as big as he was about to break through, but it snagged him his first Best New Music Award from Pitchfork. They gave the album an 8.5. Brandon Stuzoy actually reviewed that record, and Stuzo was most impressed by what he referred to as Soufiane's sad observation of the lives of the working class. A little bit similar to what Pitchfork was yammering on about when we come to the suburbs review we talked about.
Yeah, that's true. There are some similarities there. I thought this was like a pretty solid review. In fact, I think most of the reviews we're going to be talking about on this episode do a pretty good job at like tapping into what my experience is when I listen to these albums. There's a quote that stood out to me where Stuzoy says that Stevens offers both realism and idealization in his portrait. The record is stacked with impressive space for Stevens' shimmering geography, and it manages a melancholy beauty. Michigan is a frost-bound tone poem in which average people live out their victories and defeats with a shadowy, dignified grace.
I love it.
If you refer to something as a frost-bound tone poem, I'm going to want to listen to it.
That's the best piece of Pitchfork writing that we have said on this show.
It's very good. Yeah, very tasteful. And it actually achieves a certain level of poeticism, I think.
It evokes.
Yeah. Then at the end of 2003, they named Michigan their third favorite album of the year, behind The Lemon of Pink by The Books at number 2 and Echoes by The Rapture at number 1.
Wow.
When I was doing my research for this episode I realized I'd never listened to a Rapture album, although I knew that they were big around this time of the decade. Number 1 of the like best album of the year. That shocked me a little bit. I did go back and check it out, and that album is a real time capsule.
It's hard to imagine a world in which like the smart political move for Pitchfork to do is to give like a dance punk album of the year, you know?
And then like, and then at number 2, like this weird kind of sound collage of a record by The Books. I mean, they're like a cool group, like number 2 of the year. That's music journalism was in a different plane in 2003.
It sure was. This was like not even necessarily when Pitchfork had, you know, staked its claim as the tastemaker of college white boys all over America.
They were getting there though. Let's skip a year forward. Soufiane releases a collection of songs he'd recorded before he wrote Michigan as his fourth LP, Seven Swans.
Feels like we're now in the golden age of Soufiane Stevens. This run here, like hyper productive, super consistent. I personally think Seven Swans is probably just as good as Michigan. I might like it just slightly less.
I like it a bit less. It just feels a little less ambitious to me and a little more thrown together. But I do like that this was one of his records that's devoted primarily to his explorations of his like Christianity. It includes songs like retelling the Old Testament story of Abraham almost sacrificing his son, and it closes with a track about like the transfiguration of Jesus Christ.
Yeah, and like there isn't anything forced about it. There's something that feels expressive about the Christian themes without feeling evangelical about them to me.
Yeah, in fact, that was one of the big points brought up in the Pitchfork review. Do you want to talk about that?
Yeah, let's talk about that review. It got an 8.1, no best, or did they give it a Best New Music? I can't remember.
They did give it a Best New Music, which that's a low score for a Best New Music, right? I think that might be one of the lowest I've seen.
The official cutoff now feels like it's like 8.3, maybe.
Maybe. That was reviewed by Nick Sylvester. And to speak to what you were talking about, towards the end of his review, he compares Soufiane to the author Flannery O'Connor and says that a big strength that both of them have in common is their ability to take like Christian values and Christian stories and kind of turn them into something that is universally applicable, so as not to alienate any part of their audience that kind of stuff may not typically resonate with. So it's like taking something that is Christian and like applying it to something that works for his entire audience.
There's also, like, in a very Age of Oddsian way, there's, like, some body and health images on this, too. Like, it feels very tactile. It feels very visceral. It's also definitely, like, his big Christian release. I think there's great tracks all over it. I think that, like, The Dress Looks Nice on You is incredible.
The Dress Looks Nice on You, that was the single. Do you want to listen to it?
Yeah, let's hear it. Thank you.
I can see a lot of life in you. I can see a lot of bright in you. And I think the dress looks nice on you. I can see a lot of life in you.
So pretty similar to Michigan, I think, but a little more sparse. There aren't as many like string or horn arrangements, and there are less like big choirs of backing vocals and that kind of stuff.
Something Suthyan does when he's operating in the folk, I guess space is that I think is really commendable, is that he plays his guitar the way that like a pianist might play a piece, where there's a lot of like rushing and also like falling behind and letting meters kind of like hold for a second before he picks up the next one, like not being a total stickler to like kind of stay on the four, and instead like be very expressive with the way that he plays. And I think that is what makes me lock into this release. It's what makes me lock into Michigan too, in a way. And these two albums do feel very linked in my head as like I said, the kind of like second tier down. These are a couple of great records.
Yeah, I think he's a little underrated as a guitar player. I never really hear too many people like rhapsodize over his guitar work, but it's very good.
Yeah, I agree.
So at the end of that year, this was another record that made it onto Pitchfork's year-end list. They ranked it as the 17th best album of 2004, one spot ahead of The College Dropout by Kanye West.
Imagine. What a weird moment that is. I mean, you know, obviously one of those two albums people talk about a whole lot more now.
Yeah, I mean, if like we were doing an episode about The College Dropout, I would feel tempted to bet that one would get like a 10 on reissue. I don't know if I'd be saying that about Seven Swans, unfortunately.
Right. Yeah, for sure. But if you want to talk about 10 out of 10s, let's talk about Illinois.
Oh yeah, because this is a big one. Come on and feel the Illinois.
This was such a huge moment, like I still remember it pretty vividly too. I remember this album kind of taking over my social space. Everybody was playing it, talking about it. It was his first album to chart on the Billboard 200, and it was continuing the 50 States project, but differently than Michigan, I would say.
It feels somehow even more realized than that one. Like, Michigan feels kind of like a simple little indie film, maybe, and this feels like a big studio production.
Yeah, certainly the sonics of it have taken a grand leap forward. I think we should play something before we talk about it more, just because, like, it's kind of such a dense and crazy record.
Sure, why don't we play, on the album, I believe this song is referred to simply as Chicago, but the real name, which some people don't know, is actually Go, Chicago, Go! Yeah!
So, you know, this is what I'm talking about, like, dare you to call me corny.
A little bit.
Go, drove to Chicago. All things know. We sold our clothes to the state. I don't mind, I don't mind. I made a lot of mistakes in my mind. You
I mean, that's nothing short of an indie pop classic by today's standards, I would say.
And I'd say that this record is nothing short of a masterpiece. I think it still sounds explosive with ideas and technicolor and so diverse and so jam-packed. It's like a crazy collage. It's like a Henry Darger collage or something. It's just so much going on, and it's moving. There's a reason why this record still kind of hangs over the legend of Sufjan Stevens, and why it'll probably be the thing that, like, his legend is buried with, this record.
Yeah, I mean, there's really nothing else like it. It's super transportative. It not only takes you to, like, a certain place, I think, but it takes you all throughout time as he, like, explores the history of Illinois and goes through all of these events and, like, sings about all these characters like Abraham Lincoln and John Wayne Gacy.
And I do think that, like, there are people for whom this album, like, initially will make them bounce off of it for many reasons. Like we said, there's, like, a tweeness, and that's not to everybody's taste. There's the whole thing about the super crazy long album or song titles, which, like, definitely makes a lot of people roll their eyes. There's the earnestness, the cheeriness. All of these things could potentially be gatekeeping of your experience with this record. And Trevor, they were to me at the time. I remember shrugging this album off initially, and I think I was like, my go-to word was that Sufjan was like baby's first Neutral Milk Hotel or baby's first Elliott Smith or something.
Sure, he belongs in the same class as, like, the Decemberists, where, like, it's maybe a little too precious for some people. I think actually if I had come to it maybe like 4 or 5 years later, I might have bounced off it too. But, like, when I did come to it, I was, like, really, like, a big fan of this sort of, like, indie rock. So it was right up my alley.
Yeah, if you can let your aesthetic guard down, I think that the quality is kind of speaking for itself on this record. It's still a big one, Trevor. It's still a big, big one.
And Pitchfork was a big, big fan. This was the one where he finally broke through that 9.0 barrier. He got a 9.2 for this record. Best New Music, of course. The review was written by Amanda Petrusic, who still writes for Pitchfork.
I like this review. I read this review. I think that it's again, kind of on point in terms of themes and actually discusses the music in a satisfying way. Thumbs up to Amanda Petrusic.
This is another one that, like I said, it really taps into what my experience has always been listening to Illinois. In fact, I think she does it in like a single sentence where she writes, "Trumpets blare, submission looms, our eyes widen, it makes sense. Illinois is the greatest state of all time."
And that is what the record feels like.
Pretty much, yeah.
Just like a fervent, over-the-top tourist piece for the state of Illinois.
Sufjan is going to sing to you about Illinois until you love it as much as he does.
And I mean, if you want to talk about, like, legacy, at the end of 2005, Pitchfork called it the best album of the year.
Number one.
And at the end of the decade, they named it the 16th best album of the decade.
It's an extremely, extremely high placement when you're talking about 10 whole years of releases.
And if I was going to, like, make a wall board of the albums that define Pitchfork music to me, this would be, like, one of the big ones.
Definitely. It's very high up there.
So now we enter the gap. And it's, you know, there's still output in the gap.
Yeah, I mean, really no shortage of it. Like, a year later, he released The Avalanche, which was a compilation of outtakes from the Illinois sessions. And that only got a 7.6 from Pitchfork. But I feel like I've seen a lot, like, in more recent reviews, a lot of people really talk highly of this material and say that it's really not too far of a step down from Illinois.
People really like that acoustic version of Chicago, I know. And
You mean Go Chicago, Go Yeah.
Right. And I also hear the song No Man's Land get brought up a lot in terms of, like, not to be overlooked Sufjan cuts.
There are some good cuts on that release. I definitely highly recommend anybody who's a fan of Illinois checking it out.
Yeah, I admittedly I've not really spent a lot of time with this one here.
Have you spent much time with his second release of 2006, which is Songs for Christmas, a 5-CD box set of original Christmas songs and covers of Christmas standards that he recorded over the course of like 5 years?
Bro, I have been making Christmas playlists since I was 11 years old. You think I don't know Songs for Christmas forwards and backwards?
I love Songs for Christmas.
Yeah, thumbs up Songs for Christmas. It's one of my favorite little, like, pop music Christmas EPs.
And Pitchfork gave it like a 7.5, which feels pretty high for a collection of like Christmas songs, at least.
He was still their golden boy, but I think it's fair. I think it's a 7.5.
Oh yeah, definitely. And like I said, I return to this thing every holiday season.
This next thing is a thing that I really bounce off of, though.
Yeah, I can't say I've ever really, I haven't spent a lot of time with it, and I can't say I'm a fan of it, but. You know, in 2007, most of Sufjan's time was spent working on this audiovisual project of his titled the BQE, which I think is best described as a symphonic and cinematic exploration of New York City's infamous Brooklyn-Queens Expressway.
Yeah, it's like, you know what it feels like is guy who's now broken through to being a fairly big act now can, like, command a whole orchestra to do what he wants, but should he?
I mean, I'm down with him having that privilege. I don't know if this is what I would have wanted him to direct all that time and energy towards, you know.
This is kind of the pinnacle of what I would call like efforted Sufjan. It feels like there's so much work going into this and the output is so not worth the work.
Well, he did get another 7.4 from Pitchfork.
He's not out with the garbage, at least.
No, they were like relative fans of it, actually.
So then you got a real quiet period in which Sufjan does eventually say that he's not doing this 50 states thing anymore. That I think he in interviews was saying that it was a marketing ploy and a joke. Can we talk about that?
I remember when this happened and I felt seriously betrayed.
I felt like I never believed he was gonna get there, for sure. I never thought that we would ever have 50 Sufjan Stevens albums about states. But here's where I take umbrage. I don't think it was ever a joke. I think when Sufjan announced this, I think his heart was in it.
I could definitely see that being a thing, because I remember, like, I think it was in 2012, he put out another collection of Christmas songs, like another like 6 CD box set of them, and he even toured behind it. And I remember a quote going around from the first show where he played like 2 Christmas songs and he like said to the audience, like, I think I might be realizing that I've made a mistake here.
What do you make of that?
It's like you were saying, it sounds like he might have kind of bit off more than he could chew. I could see it being a similar case with the 50 states thing, where he's like, yeah, 50 states of America, I could do that, one album per state, fine, totally. And then he does 2 of them and he's like, "Who? Maybe I shouldn't have announced that. Maybe that should have just been like a private thing."
Okay, if we lived in the timeline where as soon as Illinois came out, Sufjan just started pumping these out, 3 of them a year, you know, he's got to get through the 50 states, and it has been what he has been consistently doing since. What do you think that would be like? Would it be kind of like, I remember there was a time when Chuck Palahniuk, the writer who made Fight Club, was like, had this terrible deal with his publisher where he had to publish like 2 new novels a year, and so they just became like Goosebumps books, you know, like really slapdash, you know?
Yeah, like are you asking, would we see a rapid decline in the quality of these albums?
Yeah, is there any world in which he pursues this thing, makes it to the end of the 50 states, and we're better off for it?
I think it would have just depended on how well he would have been able to sustain his own interest in the project. I think if he never lost interest in it, yeah, he could have potentially kept going and done state after state. But like we've been saying, it seems like his focus on it really did waver. And I can't imagine wanting all of these states albums from a dude who wasn't really committed to it anymore.
Yeah, so then also around this time that he kind of, like, let that bombshell drop, he also was, like, touring, and he debuted a few new songs on that tour. One of those songs was called The Age of Odds, and he also released this album with his stepfather, experimental electronic musician Lowell Brahms, called Music for Insomnia. Now, here is where Pitchfork and Sufjan part ways, because Pitchfork writer Rob Mitchum gave that record a 5.3, and he called it straight up nightmare fuel.
I've never listened to this record, but I'm having fun thinking about what Sufjan Stevens' version of nightmare fuel would be.
Well, I feel like Lowell is kind of leading the way there, but it's definitely dissonant and cacophonous, and you know, it's an album he made with his stepdad. What do you want?
It does kind of sound like it might have played like a role and his career going forward over the next couple of years. Like,
I could definitely see him consulting with Lowell on, like, you know, gear and that sort of thing as he was starting to make this next transition in his sound. But before that transition would come, Trevor, we have something. There's another weird moment in this story, which is that I guess the best way to start is that Steven was like, he made a few little contributions to the album High Violet by The National, which also came out in 2010, unfortunately before the scope of this show begins.
Yep, but I do remember hearing about this when it happened, like Sufjan popping up on his National record, which I think you and I are both big fans of.
High Violet is a huge, huge album for me, for sure. And he's on the track Afraid of Everyone, which is like one of my favorite songs on that record.
Yep, he made a surprise appearance with the band on Letterman for a live performance of that song.
Yeah, and then afterwards, Matt Berringer starts running his mouth, Trevor.
Right, it probably sounded something like, yo, Sufjan. He has that really deep baritone, right? Like Sufjan.
Yeah.
Sufjan was working on his new album at our studio, and we're gonna be playing on some of the songs.
So people are thinking there's a new Sufjan Stevens album. The National's playing on it. He's working on it. We're getting a Sufjan record, but it would turn out that Matt was not talking about The Age of Odds, the album that we would get this year. He's talking about this other release, an EP. Could you hear the quotes?
Yeah, Trevor. I mean, this guy can't even do EPs short. We're talking about All Delighted People.
Yeah,
which came out earlier in 2010, I think, and it clocked in at like a full hour. Right?
It's the man has no chill. A 60-minute long EP. It's two of the eight songs on it, Trevor, are different versions of the title track, All Delighted People.
Yeah, how about we listen to what is referred to as the original version of All Delighted People?
Okay, let's hear it.
Tomorrow you'll see it through. The clouded out disguises put you in the room. And though I wandered out alone, a thousand lights abounded on our home. And I remember every sound it made, the clouded out disguises.
Bit of a hot take here. I actually like the other version of this song, the quote classic rock version, a little better. I think this is a good tune, though.
I like this version of it better, and it's probably the keeper here for me. It is a good tune. I do think that, like, as the first like canonical Sufjan statement, or what at least feels like the first one since Illinois, there's something about it that feels weirdly grounded for an 11 and a half minute song. Like, some of the bells and the whistles are gone here. This is an earnest thing that's happening right now. And I do think that it's effective. I can kind of get rid of everything else here, though. I don't really like this release overall, Trevor.
Critics were pretty mixed on it, too. I know it got a 7.6 from Pitchfork, reviewed by our good friend Ian Cohen, who did the Suburbs review. And that was one of its higher review scores.
Yeah, he called that release humble and friendly. And other reviewers complained that the guitar work was too wanky and that the record is incohesive. I get what they're coming from with the wanky, but like, there's a lot of big solos and stuff like that.
If they thought the EP was too wanky, they must have been really thrilled with the vinyl release, which added, what, another 11 tracks in the form of these untitled piano pieces?
Yeah, I guess they were in this, like, eventually used for this short film that Natalie Portman made called Eve, but like, Trevor, at this point, you're talking about something with EP in the title that's 80 minutes long, Trevor?
Yeah, he just can't keep things brief. He can't
up is
do it.
Down, black is white, Sufjan Stevens. But it was kind of a surprisingly commercially well-received release. It got to all the way up to 27 on the Billboard 200 album charts, and it was entirely from digital sales too. That first week, it was only there from digital release.
I remember when this thing came out, I think it really came out of nowhere at the time, and people were like hungry for more Sufjan at this point. So even if it did get those mixed reviews, people were really eager to consume this thing.
It does kind of feel like the reason EP is in the title here is that these are the, I guess, the vestiges of an abandoned, what the next Sufjan Stevens album was going to be before he had this like eureka sea change moment. So it's kind of like, you know, this is Delighted People EP, because he's like, okay, well, I don't want to just like gutter all this material that I can't carry forward to where I'm going sonically. So here's what I was working on, essentially. That's what it feels like to me.
I think that feels like a pretty fair assessment. But speaking of the next proper Sufjan Stevens LP, we've finally made it to The Age of Odds.
So it was announced less than a week after Delighted People released, and, you know, talk about kind of like taking the wind out of the sails of your new record. Hang in there. The real one's coming, though. And he announced it would be coming out on October 12th. And then a month and a half before the album came out, he released the first single from the record, Trevor, I Walked, which was kind of the introduction to the fact that Sufjan had undergone a bit of a transmorphosis.
How about we listen to I Walked and hear what that transmorphosis sounded like?
Okay.
I don't think transmorphosis is a word, by the way.
Whatever. Trevor, I got the feeling we're not in Illinois anymore.
Very clever. Do you remember how you felt about this one when it came out? Did you like, were you at ground zero and did you listen to it when it dropped?
I did not listen to it when it dropped. I remember waiting for the record, and I remember people talking very feverishly about like, Sufjan's got a new record coming out, but it's not going to be, he's doing synths and like, it's electronic now and stuff. And I just remember thinking like, that's been a thing for a while. A lot of people have done this now.
Like I said, bleepy bloopy syndrome.
Bleepy bloopy syndrome. I wasn't as feverish and breathless in my anticipation of this record. So let's talk about the record. You want to talk about what you think about the record? Let's just do it.
I was one of those people who was like pretty excited by Sufjan's like new embrace of electronics. But I remember feeling pretty underwhelmed by This Is a Single when it came out. It has like since grown on me, but I remember it didn't really fire me up about the record too much
it's,
at the time
of
release.
It's a solid cut. I think you feel that 5-minute length. There's not too much going on there.
Yeah. Real mid-tempo for a first single, I think.
Yeah. I don't exactly see how it's the right move for your opening statement, maybe.
Yeah, but, you know, I might have been a little lukewarm on this one, but when the record itself dropped, I remember being a big fan of it. Like, there were a couple songs that I couldn't really get into, some of the more like minor tracks, but the big ones like Too Much, the title track.
I Want to Be Well, I imagine, was a big one.
I Want to Be Well was like, I remember that was a big talking point because he said fuck in that one. And everyone was like, Sufjan said fuck.
Yeah.
This is the guy who sings about Jesus. Now he's singing fuck. Can he do that?
What's his church group going to think?
Is he okay? Is he all right? Has his pastor heard this? Is he going to go to confession now? But yeah, that one's great. And of course, like the 25-minute closer, Impossible Soul. I was a big fan of this record when it came out. I thought it was a rousing success, even though there were songs that, like I said, I couldn't get into.
So what do you think about it now, going back to it? I mean, you've probably spent more time with it in the convening years than I have, Trevor. Has your relationship with this record changed in any way? Have you warmed up to, cooled down on? Where do you feel about Odds in this moment?
I don't know if the way I feel about it has changed in any real significant way. I think, like, looking back on it now, I do think that this was, like, a pretty big moment in, like, the Sufjan Stevens narrative. And when it comes down to it, it's like a really solid record musically.
Let's look at this moment that's happened over and over again in a lot of different recording artists' mythology. And like, let's go ahead and just get out of the way. Like the gold standard of this moment in your discography still belongs to Radiohead. The transition from OK Computer into Kid A, the story behind that of the band, like all disagreeing on what the next, move was going to be, Phil Selway saying like, we should make another one like the Bends and big riffs, and like eventually them all kind of sitting down, learning how to use synthesizers, learning how to use drum beats, and trying to credibly make electronic music together. Credibly is the functioning word here for me, Trevor. I think my problem with The Age of Odds is that it does feel a little bit to me like a folk music artist fiddling with knobs and stuff.
Yeah, I could see that as like a valid complaint. Maybe he doesn't. I remember like some people thinking he didn't go as in on the electronics as he could have, because it was a big talking point. But there is really a lot of stuff on this record that is still like pretty consistent with the kind of music he was making previously. There are a lot of lush arrangements. There are still some folksy guitars. There's a lot of that hushed delivery that he was known for.
And I mean, there's the most, I think, commendable thing about it is the kind of exposing of the soul of oneself that goes on this record. It definitely feels like we're cutting so close to the skin on this one.
That's very commendable. And something else that I really like about it, which is probably came away as my favorite thing about it when it came to revisiting it this time around, is I like the way it kind of subverts and messes with what we had come to expect from him by this point. Like, yeah, maybe it is not a 100% turnabout and like a real commitment to the electronic sound, but it is still very much like a deconstruction of what a Sufjan Stevens album is supposed to sound like. And I like whenever an artist who gets to the level that Sufjan was at this point kind of decides to mess with their sound and see how their audience will react to a record not sounding like they're expecting it to sound.
This record defines what I'm talking about when I talk about the kind of Sufjan Stevens record that I think is very interesting to think about and talk about, and more so than it is like enjoyable for me to sit down and listen to. I do think that, like, dude, you can cut some songs.
Yeah.
The runtime is an issue for me here.
And maybe some of the ones that are super long, like I Walked is a good example. Too Much also has like a very long extended outro. Maybe you could cut some of that stuff going on in those tracks.
Yeah.
Ironically, I wouldn't shave a second off of the 25-minute closer.
No, in a way, it almost feels like the imagine if this release had just been that song. Like, I feel like people would think about it very differently. I think it would be seen as a more major work in the Sufjan catalog. I don't think that that's necessarily the better timeline, because I think there's some really good stuff on here. I really like the title track. In fact, coming back to it this time, Trevor, I feel like maybe my appreciation of the title track of Age of Odds has even maybe in some ways overtaken my appreciation for Impossible Soul, because I find that it's like it gets me there just as good, but it's not as much of a commitment for me.
The one that really grew on me preparing for the show this time around was Vesuvius. Something I never noticed in that track before somehow is that he kind of sings his own name in the chorus and addresses it to himself. And I'm always a big fan of like singers doing meta shit like that.
To me, that feels like very informative of like the car seat headrest, like stoner rock, early 2010 stuff that started popping up after this record.
Yeah, it was kind of like a forebear for that kind of stuff, wasn't it?
Yeah. I wish that I had a lot of cool stories to tell you about the making of this album, but Sufjan's like, he's got a real tight lid on that stuff.
Yeah, unfortunately, no like Bradford Cox anecdote about like going for a drive and coming back to his favorite Deer Hunter song this time around.
I mean, even the liner notes don't credit any of the personnel. All we know about personnel we've learned from like interviews and stuff. Like, for example, we know that St. Vincent sings backing vocals on Now That I'm Older. My Brightest Diamond frontwoman Sharon Nova plays the guitar solo on Impossible Soul. She also sings like some of the verses on that song as well.
Yeah, I think she does like backing vocals throughout, if not that whole song, the whole album, I think.
I gotta say, I think that's kind of a messed up thing to do.
Not release a personnel list, credit like the people who worked on it.
I think that like people talk about entertainment unions being kind of like a pain in the ass and like getting in the way of artists' intents and the statements they want to make. And there are places where they've gone too far with that in like the film industry, where they're like, they'll fine a production for not putting credits at the beginning of their movie or whatever. But at the end of the day, if you hire a person and you're putting this product out with your name on it, it feels like disingenuous to me to not credit that person and give them what's fairly theirs for however people are going to react to it.
Not very Christian of you, Sufjan.
Yeah, not incredibly Christian. We do know a little bit about like what was going on in Sufjan's head that went into this record, though.
Right, he was suffering like with an illness around this time, right? I know like he talked about this in an interview with Exclaim magazine, where he said he was going through some very serious health issues. It prevented him from working. And like for several months, he couldn't really do anything. And when he went back to the process of recording music, he wasn't really sure how he wanted to approach it. And that kind of resulted in him branching off in this new direction.
That, I think, if nothing else, you know, maybe that doesn't explain the kind of the drum machines and the synthesizers, but it definitely like speaks to the fact that we are getting this unguarded portrait of a guy thinking about himself, being hypercritical of himself. There's a lot of like, you know, unflattering moments for Sufjan on this record as well. I think that when you go through a health crisis like that, it's such a clarifying thing. Your eyes are kind of so open about like who you are. And I do think that that informed, you know, lyrically at least, a lot of the directions this record took.
Yeah, that kind of thing is like a sobering event, and this is an album that feels like it's the product of a sobering event.
Certainly the slow burn of the legacy of Illinois had a big commercial impact when it came to the release of Odds.
Right, this was another big seller, right? It sold 36,000 copies. It debuted at number 7 on the Billboard 200, and it also topped Billboard's rock albums, independent albums, alternative albums, and folk albums charts. You knew Billboard had so many charts.
There's a few of these descriptors that I don't exactly know how well they apply to this record, Trevor.
Well, independent albums are very different from alternative albums. You got to remember that.
Yeah, for sure.
And to promote this one, he also made his first television appearance. I remember when this happened. He performed the second single from the record, Too Much, on Jimmy Fallon. You want to listen to Too Much?
Let's play Too Much, and then let's talk about the idea of Too Much as the second single from Age of Odds.
I gotta say, if I were Sufjan Stevens, I don't know if I would be secure enough in myself and my body of work to release a song titled Too Much. I feel like you're maybe opening up yourself for a little bit of, like, ironic criticism, but I gotta respect the guy for going for it.
Especially with a pop song that, like, you know, gets precariously close to the 7-minute mark. You know, calling it too much is something here. You're certainly inviting some snarky retorts.
Like I said, though, I remember when this performance happened, and I still think it feels like a big coming out moment for this album and this new era of Sufjan's career. Like, I think this was the first time we saw him with those big angel wings he would wear, like, while performing during this era. And, like, he was covered in all this, like, Dayglo body paint, and he had these backup dancers, and they were, like, popping, locking around. It was definitely a big departure for the dude aesthetically.
So here's what I think about Too Much. I think that the moment that it starts when you're listening to Age of Odds is, like, it's maybe the biggest, craziest moment on the record, right? Because you start with what is it called? Feudal Devices?
Feudal Devices. I love that as an opener.
You start with Feudal Devices, which is not out of place on what we know about Sufjan's output up to this point. You know, it's pretty traditionally...
Largely a folk number.
Yeah, pretty traditionally arranged, and then you like, get hit with all this, like, electronic cacophony. And it made me realize that I think the best way to have rolled this record out, Trevor, would have been to have no pre-release single, to really lock down the pre-interview stuff, and to, you know, not set up any expectations, and then just kind of, like, say there's going to be a Sufjan Stevens record this year, maybe shadow drop it, at, you know, the way that you can now. Maybe it was harder to do back then, of course. And then you just get this crazy moment where you put on the first new Sufjan Stevens record in 5 years, and suddenly, you know, 2.5 minutes into the record, what's going on, right?
That would have been pretty dope if it had been, like, if the stylistic change had been a surprise. Yeah, I would have enjoyed that for sure.
It would have hit in an interesting way, definitely. I do think it's a strong song, and if you were going to pick one of them for a first single, Too Much wouldn't have been a bad choice. I would have picked it over I Walked, probably.
Yeah, it's got much higher energy. I think it works better as a single, too.
So we've been picking this record apart, but let's kind of look at how other people are talking about this record, Trevor.
Yeah, what did the critics think about Age of Odds when it came out?
Well, let's look to Metacritic for the answer to that question. It's got an average review score of 80 out of 100 based out of 33 critic reviews. So that's highly acclaimed, if not universally acclaimed. James Skinner of Drowned in Sound gave it an 8 out of 10 and said, "Impossible Soul closes proceedings with a running time of over 25 minutes. Take a moment. That's Paranoid Android 4 times over. Longer than an episode of The Simpsons. It demands to be taken on its own terms. It is undeniably, absolutely impressive."
Yeah, I mean, I think that song is pretty airtight when it comes to 25-minute tracks. Do you want to listen to a little bit of it, and maybe we could, like, leave it playing under this segment just because it's so long?
Yeah, put on Impossible Soul. It's still, it's a big one.
While Sufjan does his thing, let's keep going through it.
Yeah, so not everybody was hot on the record, Trevor.
Right, I know that the... Is this site now defunct? Coke Machine Glow?
Yeah, it was one of my spots that I would always check back in the day.
It was a... Coke Machine Glow is a great name for an indie music blog, I will say. I do remember them being, like, a little harder to impress than Pitchfork and Stereogum more frequently were, I think.
Yeah, Don Cinacola of Coke Machine Glow, no rating, but he wasn't so hot on it. And Trevor, I would love if you would do the honor of reading this Don Cinacola review quote.
Sure, he's talking about one of the tracks from the album here, Bad Communication. He says, "Bad communication throbs impatiently with laser zaps, bloops, blibbles, splashes of turpentine, more and more voices, cadiddles, a mandolin maybe, the ploopy facsimile of E.T. picking his nose. I am running out of conceivable onomatopoeia for this crap."
I do gotta say, I go back and forth on this quote, but I actually think that this is like a good little funny piece of writing about being like, you know, kind of over something.
He definitely makes Sufjan's case of bleepy bloopy syndrome sound pretty terminal.
Definitely. Okay, so I read every posted critical review of this record that was still archived and available, and I kind of, you know, figured out what the most common talking points were, so I thought I'd take you through them, Trevor.
All right, let's hear them.
They all mentioned that it uses electronic instrumentation and that is a major stylistic departure.
Could have seen that coming.
They say that it's messy and it does not have a central concept the way that the records that he put out so far did.
It's a true point.
They say that it's very personal and that it's very intimate.
Something we've been saying the entire episode.
Everybody talks about that the last track is 25 minutes long. It's a pretty divisive read on the track. Some people are very much not on board, and those who aren't really cite the use of auto-tune as being where they get off board.
Auto-tune was still a big polarizing thing back in 2010, wasn't it?
Yeah, remember like the year before, Vampire Weekend on Contra had what was that song called, Cousin?
That was also 2010. I think that was California English, actually, that had the auto-tune. And yeah, people were not here for that. Even though it was only on the track for like a couple seconds, they were like, what's auto-tune doing on a Vampire Weekend song?
Yeah, it feels like one of two things is happening in that moment. When the indie kids kind of revolt against artists embracing the... And remember, we're talking about... Now when we think about auto-tune, this is all we think about. The kind of vocal effect that it can give. We're talking about a misuse of a piece of software. You know, this is not what this software was created for. It was created to correct pitch, right? And I believe it was Cher's Believe was the first time a couple of producers figured out that, like, if you dug into the guts of that software and messed with it, you could get this weird vocal effect where it feels like, you know, there's no glissando between notes. You're just harshly skipping from one note to the other. And I feel like in some of what's going on here with critics and fans who don't like this is that they don't like the idea of using auto-tune to perfect everybody's pitch, which I think is a totally valid complaint to make. And it has homogenized, you know, the way pop voices sound like. You know, pop musicians, they used to have kind of characterful voices. Madonna was not the best singer in the world. It was part of her charm. I get why they resisted that. But once it bleeds over into the stylistic application of auto-tune, it kind of feels like this uncomfortable moment, like rock fans burning disco records and shit, where you have white music fans who are like, keep that hip-hop garbage out of my Sufjan Stevens record.
Which you hate to see, especially when artists like Sufjan, and I think particularly like Justin Vernon, Bon Iver, were finding like really cool artistic things to do with this software.
It's weird to think about it as such a dividing thing at that time.
Yeah.
The artists that this record got composed to the most were Kid A, which I've already done myself, Bjork,
yep,
and Giorgio Moroder.
Bjork is another really accurate point of comparison, I think.
I think that there's a little bit of Bjork DNA in Sufjan, which is easy to overlook.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
Let's talk about the people, though, right?
Yeah, let's go to the streets, hear what the average Joe thinks about Age of Odds.
Okay, so we're going to rate your music. The review score average is 3.79 out of 5. Respectable for Rate Your Music.
Definitely.
They rank it as the fourth best Sufjan Stevens album behind Michigan and Carrie and Lowell and Illinois.
And more broadly, they rank it as the sixth best album of 2010. Just behind an album we've already discussed, The Suburbs by Arcade Fire.
Yeah, I would say it's probably my fifth best Sufjan Stevens album, and I would also put Swans above it.
I don't know if I'd put Swans above it. I would say it's probably like my third or fourth favorite Sufjan album.
Gotcha. And it was. It's also ranked on Rate Your Music as the 478th best album of all time, just behind Vision Creation Newsen by Boredoms.
Never been able to get into Boredoms. I've given them a couple shots. They're a little too weird for me, I think, maybe.
I feel ya. Let's look at the track breakdowns. Rate Your Music gives Impossible Soul the best rating at a 4.5. Right behind it, Feudal Devices, that folky opening track at 4.4. And then there's like a three-way tie for third. All of them got 4.3s. That's Age of Odds, Vesuvius, and I Want to Be Well.
All those are great tracks. The bottom-rated track is the one that our pal at Coke Machine Glow referred to as E.T. picking his nose, Bad Communication, which got a 3.5.
Oh, I do not like that song, Trevor.
Yeah, I'd cut that one. Yeah.
The top-rated positive review on Rate Your Music by Flying Will says, first listen, what a fucking mess, 2.0. 10th listen, what a fucking mess, 4.0. Conclusion, this album is a great fucking mess.
And then the top-rated negative review by user Swimmo says, this is an event album, even by my standards, whether I like it or not, parentheses, edit, I do not.
That's a top tier edit.
Yeah. You really buried the lead there.
Pitchfork, though. Can we talk about Pitchfork?
That's what we're here to do. Let's talk about what Pitchfork thought of the Age of Odds. They were a fan.
They gave it an 8.4 out of 10, so we are taking a big step down from Illinois. We're not up in that 9.0 sonic barrier again.
Back into like Michigan territory.
Yes. Ryan Domball, the feature editor, reviewed this one, Trevor. I think that this is a pretty good review.
I think it's an okay review. I do have a little bit of an issue where he goes with it towards the end, when he starts talking about like the diminishing importance of the album and the digital marketplace.
That's the most dated thing about that, because I remember everybody having this conversation ad nauseum at this time, Trevor, about...
And it just didn't really feel like a big talking point when it came to this record. I think maybe it would have been worth bringing up when you got something like that All Delighted People EP. And like, you know, because that's an album that asks a lot of questions about release formats, but I don't know if that's super applicable when it comes to Age of Odds.
I think that there are people who consume music in the form of albums, and there are people who consume music in the form of individual songs. There always have been, and there always will be, and the shifting marketplace doesn't have much of a bearing on it.
And I guess the point you wanted to make was that Sufjan is definitely still making music for people who consume things as albums.
And that bears forward for the rest of his career too. He also said, I like this quote, he said, surrounding himself with music that expertly balances between over-orchestrated and chaotic, Stevens elevates his pedestrian travails about love and lust into legendary myths in which he's rarely the hero. That does, I think, get on one of my favorite things about the record, which again is this idea that like it's a self-portrait that does not obsessively flatter itself.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't go as far as like Pinkerton maybe, but he's definitely not propping himself up here.
Yeah.
And I do think that is a good quote. It really is consistent with, I think, the way Pitchfork has through the years kind of really tastefully and poetically written about these Sufjan records and ways that I connect with and kind of and ways that make me want to listen to them as well.
Odds would do pretty well on the year end list. Number 25 best album of 2010, according to Pitchfork.
Yeah, and then at the end of the decade, they named it 147 on their list of the 200 best albums of the 2010s.
Now, we're talking about rankings and lists, so let's pop on over to besteveralbums.com and look at some of the metadata about how this record gets ranked when journalists are making lists. It is ranked as the number 3 best Sufjan Stevens album behind Carrie and Lowell and Illinois.
Carrie and Lowell, his 2015 album.
Yeah, and it appeared in 500 published lists, year-end, decade-end, and all-time, ranked as the 9th best album of 2010, just behind Brothers by the Black Keys, which, jeez.
They're kind of like, the Black Keys are kind of big shit talkers, right? Like in interviews and stuff, they kind of do the Gallagher thing. What do you think they would like say if they wanted to try and start a beef with Sufjan Stevens?
Oh, yeah, that's a good point. I guess they would be like, well, at this time, of course, they would be like, dude never even learned to rock out. He used to just kind of be a little wussy on his banjo and he went straight to his little knobs or whatever, something like that.
Yeah, like, I've heard the dude's a Christian. Doesn't he know that using drum machines is a sin?
Best Ever Albums has it ranked as the 37th best album of the 2010s, also just behind Brothers by the Black Keys, an album that, according to Best Ever Albums, Trevor, is exactly one album better than Age of Odds.
That's what it sounds like. When it comes to every album ever released in the history of music, I guess, it was ranked number 315, just behind Sea Change by Beck.
Shoot from the hip. Which of those two records do you like better?
I feel like there are like some similarities you can talk about there, because both of those albums are kind of find the artists that put them out, kind of taking the preconceived notions of the music they were supposed to be making and kind of doing something else. Like, you know, Beck was always steeped in irony and like hip hop samples and that kind of stuff. And Sea Change saw him becoming like a very sincere folk artist. Where you almost kind of got the opposite here, where you got like
the negative image of Age of Odds.
Yeah, almost. But I don't know. I might go with Age of Odds just on the strength of like Impossible Soul. Although I do like that Beck record.
I don't think there's anything on Sea Change that's as good as Impossible Soul, but I think overall I like Sea Change more.
It's easier to get through.
What happens now? What goes on then? Does he then decide, now I'm going to make 50 albums about myself?
I mean, his next album was like his most personal one ever. It dealt a lot with his like life growing up and his mother and stepfather. That was Carrie and Lowell, which he released in 2015. That one received a lot of praise from critics, and I know a lot of people even consider that one to be better than Illinois Now.
Yeah, that's the common take you'll hear is that, nah, man, not Illinois. Carrie and Lowell is actually the best Sufjan Stevens record. Well, hopefully we'll talk about it on a future episode, because it did get Best New Music.
I can't wait to discuss that in 5 years with you.
So in 2017, Sufjan contributed a couple of songs to the soundtrack of the romantic drama Call Me By Your Name, which also weirdly featured a remix of that opening track from Age of Odds, Futile Devices.
Yeah, I think the big song from that soundtrack was Mystery of Love, because that one was nominated for Best Original Song at the 2018 Academy Awards. And he even played it live at the ceremony. He was dressed in this really snappy kind of pink and green or something? Pinstripe jacket?
I've heard some people say some very over-the-top crazy things about that song, Mystery of Love. I've heard people call that, like, you know, like one of his singular masterpieces, and that it's, like, the best song he's ever made. I don't know. I haven't spent that much time with it.
Yeah, most recently, though, he released a new LP just, like, a week or so ago, The Ascension, which also reached, like, 80 minutes in length.
Yeah, and the critical reception of The Ascension has been so far, like, I would say positive. It's not like people are not falling over themselves for this record, Trevor.
No, and personally, I found it to be like pretty middle of the pack when it comes to Sufjan releases. I would maybe put it on the same level of Seven Swans, but I don't think it's as good as either of the 50 States albums or this record, and not as good as Carrie and Lowell either.
Critics tend to call it accomplished, but they also tend to use words like challenging and inaccessible. Pitchfork mm-hmm. writer Sam Sadomski gave Ascension a tepid 7.0 out of 10 and called it, by design, kind of a drag, a dark and emotionally distant mood piece whose lyrics rarely touch on the specifics necessary to anchor the music, and whose music is rarely exciting enough to elevate his words.
Yeah, so they didn't even rate that one as high as like the Christmas EPs.
I think, and I've only listened to the record once since it's come out, I think it marks an interesting moment for Sufjan, where never more so than now, he seems totally uninterested, or at least like unintimidated by his audience. He's not seeming to make overtures to get you to like his stuff anymore. It feels like in some ways, it feels like the kind of rawest, truest expression that he's done. But I do think that, like, if there's a timeline where I love this record, it is one where I put in a lot of work getting to know it, and I just don't see that happening.
Yeah, I think it would have been like a better listen for me if it had like been around 45 or 50 minutes. It wasn't something that like proved to be able to sustain my attention for its entire runtime. But I feel like there are some like good cuts in there to check out.
And now we're current on the myth, the legend of Sufjan Stevens.
Which means it's time for my favorite, I don't know about you, but my favorite segment on the show, where you and I bet a crisp $10 bill on whether or not we think that this record, The Age of Odds by Sufjan Stevens, will receive that coveted perfect 10 from Pitchfork if it is ever re-reviewed in the future. When it's inevitably re-reviewed. It's going to happen someday, right?
Trevor, I'm feeling like a riverboat gambler this week. I'm going to take the long odds here.
This would be two in a row for you.
I'm going to take it. I got this weird feeling that over the next decade, the rock and roll malaise that has turned the singer-songwriter medium and stringed instruments into a more and more diminishing commercial art form is going to spread in such a big way to listeners, to critics. I think people are going to start forsaking classic records that use guitar, bass, and drums. And I think that I could see, in a decade, maybe a decade and a half from now, this being the only Sufjan Stevens record that even sounds like music to people anymore, Trevor.
I didn't think about it from that perspective, but I feel like you've actually got kind of a strong argument there.
Yeah, I'm going to do it. I say I'll bet $10. If I'm out, maybe my kid doesn't get Lunchable that week, but I'll take the action.
Yeah, I'm unfortunately not feeling as bold as you are this time around. I do think, looking back, this was a big moment for Sufjan Stevens and his career, but I don't know if 10 years later, it kind of has the same impact as it did back then, at least not in the greater context of all of indie music and all of blog rock. So I'm gonna keep that $10 bill in my pocket this time around.
I guess we'll find out unless we all die before then.
Let's hope not, because we have a real corker of an album to talk about next time, Dylan. Do you wanna tell the listeners what we're gonna be discussing on our next episode?
We're gonna be discussing this Well, it's this fantasy that I have. It's beautiful.
Would it happen to be maybe a little on the dark side?
It is dark. I'll come right out and say it's pretty dark.
And Dylan, knowing you, in addition to being beautiful and dark, I wouldn't be surprised if this fantasy was a little twisted as well.
Well, I wasn't going to say it, but since you are... yes, we'll be back next month on the 22nd of November to discuss My Beautiful Dark Twisted Fantasy by the... I just tried to pack all of what we feel and think about Kanye in 2020 into a quick clean.
Oh, you can't do it.
Clean descriptor, and my brain literally hitched like it was a Windows 95 machine.
We're gonna be having Thanksgiving with Kanye West. How fun will that be? The album in question is, of course, My Beautiful Dark Twisted Fantasy.
I mean, that's a record. You say its name and the temperature in the room changes, Trevor.
It's gonna be an interesting time talking about whether we think it's gonna get a 10 upon reissue, because it currently has a 10 on the site right now.
That might be like a real roundtable when we get to that part of the episode, Trevor.
I can't wait, but for now, how about you just tell everybody where they can find us online and stuff?
Yeah, absolutely. You should check us out on Twitter. The show's account is pre-10pod, P-R-E number 10, P-O-D. And you can also find my delightful co-host, Trevor, on Twitter at Trevor Ickrath with all the vowels taken out, T-R-V-R-K-R-T-H.
And you can find my wonderful co-host on Twitter at Dylan Flynn. Although Dylan might not be spelled the way you think it is. It's D-I-L-L-O-N.
Yeah, like Matt Dylan, not Bob Dylan.
And there's two N's on Flynn at the end. Just since we're spelled stuff.
Just do your best. Do your best out there. Very excited for next month, Trevor. I had a joy hanging out with you this time. I'm excited to keep the pretentious train going. But until next time, I've been Dylan Flynn.
I've been Trevor Ickrath. Dylan, why don't you hit our listeners with our fancy new sign-off?
Stick a fork in us. We're done.
One, two.